I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. If you're a gardener or a farmer, this is your time of year when you've planted most of your crops and are hoping for the right mix of sun and rain so you can harvest your fruits and veggies over the next months. You don't have to live in the country, though, to grow your food. In fact, urban agriculture is growing in popularity, including here in Philadelphia, which has had a vibrant gardening community and farming movement for years that have transformed whole neighborhoods. There are close to 500 plots being tended by residents in the city. The problem is about half of them are on abandoned land or are on land owned by someone else. With developers looking for places to build apartments and offices, local growers can lose out because they don't have the resources or the wherewithal to stake their claim. Well, today in Radio Times, Farming in Philadelphia, we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Ashley Richards is Philadelphia's first urban agriculture director at the Philadelphia Parks and Recreation Department. They're a city planner that co-chairs the city's Food Policy Advisory Council Urban Agriculture Subcommittee. Ash Richards, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for having me as well.
You're welcome. Ebony Griffin is the other co-chair of the Planning Council, and she's also a staff attorney at the Public Interest Law Center. Her cases focus on land use rights, environmental justice for low-income communities and communities of color. Her work includes the Garden Justice Legal Initiative, providing legal aid to community gardens in the Philadelphia area. Ebony Griffin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm excited to be here.
Nice, excited to have you here as well. And rounding out our trio of guests is Lon Din, and she's Farm Projects Director at Viet Lead, where she works to create sustainable urban farms and gardens in the region's Vietnamese and Southeast Asian communities. Lon Din, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines always open, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ash, I have such a basic question for you to get our conversation started, but I think for a lot of people, they hear the word agriculture and they see tractors and rolling fields of corn. Mm-hmm. When we talk about urban agriculture, what are we talking about?
I think that definitely the three of us can hopefully answer that question, you know, granted our backgrounds. But I think that urban agriculture is not just about the tractor. And in many ways, it's not even just about growing the food. This is a lot about cultural heritage. It's about tradition. It's about seed saving. It's about community cohesion. You know, gardens and farms are one of the many places that people come together in. And of course, I work for Parks and Recreation, so right. We're invested in making spaces where people come together. But the gardens and farms, they're an extension of that open space network for our agency. And we're fortunate to have a long history in this city of, you know, robust traditions of urban agriculture rooted in African-American immigrant and refugee communities. And that has nurtured the city across generations, and it's nurtured the city in many different ways.
Can we use then farming and agriculture sort of interchangeably talk during the hour?
I think so. At this time, I think so. And I think that over the years, we've sort of seen the state and the federal government recognize urban agriculture across the board. Before, it's sort of like we were just thinking about agriculture as a practice that happens in the rural America. But in city planning, we sort of think about the city and the urban city and the rural America. It's happening in the urban cities too, and so we should pay attention to that. And I think the federal government, state government, city governments are starting to recognize, hey, there's something going on here. We need to foster that and support it, grow it, because it's happening anyway. I mean, lots of gardens, the history of gardening, it's from the people. It wasn't started by agencies, institutions, or nonprofits. It started with people.
And oftentimes people seeing something, an open plot in their neighborhood and deciding, we're going to take this over. Lon Din, let me ask you a little bit about what you do and the kind of work that you have done here, both in Philadelphia, but also across the river in New Jersey as well. And you come from a family of Vietnamese farmers, right, and fishers?
Yes.
So bringing that tradition with you?
Definitely. So I think, really going off of what Ash brought up, of the really long, rich tradition of gardening and farming in Philly, and how when we really look back to the history of Philly in the 1970s during deindustrialization, and, you know, jobs, manufacturing jobs being closed and people leaving, you know, a lot of white flight into the suburbs, And so what was left was, you know, vacant land, land that was blighted, that people were not taking care of. And what people really beautifully did, and they came together and they reclaimed these plots. They reclaimed these plots, you know, first as a way possibly to feed themselves, sure. You know, to have control over the food that they were eating, to grow cultural foods that they might not have had access to in food markets. And then also, as Ash was saying, and using that as also as a way to build community cohesion, to have an actual public space where people could come together, have conversations, and grow together and build relationships across cultures. And, you know, that that is a really rich tradition of African-American immigrant and refugee communities in Philly. And I think the work that I do, you know, is builds off of that. And that is builds off of that in terms of that long, rich history of folks who've been doing that for a long time.
And I do want to pick up on that. Ebony Griffin, let me get you in on the conversation. Both Ash and Lon have talked about the fact that there was a time in the city when people were leaving, essentially kind of abandoning parts of the city, including abandoning land and plots. And now we're in a slightly different situation. You see urban renewal or gentrification happening. How has that affected the kind of farming, gardening that we're seeing in Philadelphia?
That's a really loaded question. I think that gentrification has played a huge role in the increase in my caseload. There are a lot of gardens in the city. Most of those gardens are not secure in the sense that the people that are gardening or growing on them do not necessarily have legal title to that land. And what happens is you have developers that will come in and they will offer the gardeners, you know, okay, hey, you know, you're on this land. We see that there's a lot of property taxes on it. We'll pay those property taxes off, you know, in exchange for the title. You can, in theory, keep growing on it. We just want to own it. And then, you know, they come and they kick the gardeners off. You have situations where the gardens are just lost at sheriff sale and developers are snatching them up really quickly. We have seen lots of issues of fraudulent deeds where instances where someone will come and say, hey, my great uncle owned this parcel and he left it to me and now you have to go. And then they flip it and sell it to developers and then it becomes condos. So it really has sort of shifted the focus. I've been in my role for almost exactly 2 years. It'll be 2 years in a couple of weeks. And I've seen a shift from sort of trying to work strategically to get, you know, title to individual clients and individual to gardens. And that's still what we do. But it's also a lot of putting out fires right now where sure. We're having to intervene in an instance where a garden has been lost or is threatened to be lost and trying to figure out what to do there. So there's definitely a shift, I will say.
Well, and I'm thinking, I've read stories of plots that have been cultivated for not just years, but sometimes even decades, mm-hmm. Where, I mean, maybe they don't technically own the land, but they have preserved it and they're working it and have created a green space in the middle of a city environment.
Yeah, that's one of my primary goals as director of the Garden Justice Legal Initiative. We do a lot of community education, and we hold what we call vacant land 215s. We actually had one about a month and a half ago, and we're planning another one right now. And my goal through that is to let people know that you might not technically own the land, but you can, especially if it's a situation where you've been taking care of it for decades. And a lot of the legal tools that we use, or one of the primary legal tools that we use, is this ancient legal theory called adverse possession, wow. Which essentially says that if you've been taking care of land for 21 years or more, you are entitled to legal title to that land. And there are some requirements that you have to meet. Specifically, your use of the land has to have been actual, continuous, visible, notorious, distinct, and hostile. All sound very...
Yeah, it does, yeah.
For 21 years. And the statutory period, of course, varies across the country. It's really a state-by-state thing. And Pennsylvania has one of the longest statutory periods. They recently reduced it for very specific situations. For example, side yards. If you have been taking care of a side yard for, I believe it's 10 years, then
that qualifies, but generally the statutory period is 21 years. So,
Ash, let me go back to you because there's something that you wanted to say even before we got this conversation started about ownership. And,
yes.
And you know, we've been throwing that word around.
It's true.
And you have, have some thoughts
thanks,
about that.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. And I wanted to sort of kick off this conversation because, first and foremost, we want to recognize that the fact that we're talking about a lot of different issues today, intersecting issues, mm-hmm. but the primary issue we're talking about today is land. And I want to contextualize the conversation by honoring the original stewards of what is currently known as Philadelphia, which is the Lenni Lenape tribal nation. And I want to honor that history and that their presence and their resiliency and their resistance as an important foundation to our conversation. And that's something that we practice throughout the urban agriculture community across the city. And that's something that I know that Lon and Ebony support as well.
So stewardship may be better than ownership?
Yeah, it's interesting because we're responding to the way that our system views land. So we have to have ownership. But really, this is about stewardship as well. And we really have to recognize that the original stewards of this land, who has been working this land over time historically. So this is not something that happens in a vacuum. Urban agriculture is not, sort of a hobby. There's a history of farming with people of color in this country. And Philadelphia is certainly a part of that history.
Let me ask you about the Philadelphia Urban Agriculture Plan request for proposals. I read through that, and the idea is to have a plan, have a proposal.
Absolutely.
It's a bit complicated. I mean, you can't just say, hey, I want to grow some cabbage over here.
Yeah,
you have to have
true.
A plan.
You have to have a plan, and I think that the plan is responding to certainly garden advocates over the course of many, many, many years. More recently, we've seen a group called Soil Generation sort of come and rise up to the ranks as sort of saying we want to build a coalition of gardeners and farmers coming together to address these challenges. The other group that I think also has been making recommendations is the Food Policy Advisory Council, which mm-hmm. Ebony and I co-chair the Urban Agriculture Subcommittee. So over the years, FPAC makes recommendations to the mayor. That's in our charter. And there's FPACs all over the country. Philadelphia graciously has one here, and it's very active. So we were listening, of course, to the recommendations for the city to sort of step up, needing to take a larger role. So Parks and Rec, I think, wanted to sort of take a step in the right direction of leadership, because if we were going to do a plan, we need someone to manage the plan, and we need someone to implement that plan, right? So we don't want this thing to sort of sit on a shelf and get dusty. That's just like a chronic problem in city planning for planners, right? And so we can't let that happen. So we went through a whole process. Rather than just sort of diving into it and putting out an RFP, we spent the last 2 years working with different groups. We worked with this racial and economic justice group, Courageous, to corral the external community. So that's the institutions, nonprofits. What's that noise?
That means we're coming up in a
break. Oh, sorry.
I did warn our guests. I said,
that's right.
That's okay.
That's
very funny.
Yeah,
when you hear that music, it means we're coming up in a break.
Yes, okay.
So hold that
pause.
Thought,
you
Ash.
Got it. You
we'll
got
be
it.
Right
My
back.
Pleasure.
We are talking about farming in Philadelphia. And yes, we're live. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about urban agriculture, what Philadelphia is doing to help farmers and gardeners get access to land, cultivate crops, build community. Ash Richards is Philadelphia's first urban agriculture director at the Philadelphia Parks and Recreation Department. Ebony Griffin, staff attorney at the Public Interest Law Center, working on things like land use and environmental justice. And Lon Din is farm projects director at Viet Lead, where she works to create sustainable urban farms and gardens in the region's Vietnamese and Southeast Asian communities. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ash, you were talking about this.
That's right.
A plan. We can't do justice to all the details of the plan,
but there is
a plan.
There is a plan. And so in collaboration with FPAC, the city went to William Penn and asked for some funding to start this plan. And so they granted us that funding, which is excellent because we we're in it for the long haul. I mean, this is really important because we've never done this before. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of city agencies over the years have been doing a tremendous amount of work, but we weren't working together. So this is our opportunity to sort of have a coordinated, concerted effort to do this. We're going to have a robust community engagement process where we're going to be talking with nonprofit organizations, city agencies, gardeners, and we're sort of going to think about what is the state of urban agriculture in the city today? What's the long-term plan for urban agriculture? What are the roles that we need to play? What are the pathways and opportunities to support urban agriculture through this work? And of course, a part of that is land, but a lot of that is also about resources.
Sure.
And programming and staffing. And, you know, how do we employ youth after they go through a program at Saul, for example? Saul High School has a tremendous agricultural program.
Yes, they
what
do.
Happens to them when they graduate? So these are the critical things that we are trying to think about and that we'll explore during the planning process.
Lon, let me go back to you and talk a little bit about some of the work. How many gardens, for instance, part of Yet Lead? Where are the gardens and how many in Philadelphia?
Mm-hmm. So our first community farm was in Camden, New Jersey. So the Southeast Asian population resettled in both areas, because of low-income housing. So folks flocked to parts of South Philly, West Philly, Camden. So our first community farm started 8 years ago in Camden called Wow. Resilient Roots. And it's at 29th and Kramer Street. Anybody over there in Camden?
Hello.
And, you know, it really started as a community project to build intergenerational relationships with refugee elders and the younger generation who felt, you know, the community felt that there was a gap, a social isolation gap, language gap, and that actually through creating a space where elders' knowledge around land could be uplifted, you know, the elders could teach the young people how to grow, and that the elders had a chance, had a space to just come together and, you know, feel in control of their lives and to feel affirmed for their knowledge, that, you know, that could really meet community cohesion and also, achieve this really real issue of food access in Camden.
You know, what's so interesting, I think, about urban agriculture is that it is as much about community as it is about food and, you know, access to food, sort of indigenous food, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, food of the ancestors. But the social part is such a powerful part of what this is all about.
It is. It is a really successful project. And we were bringing students from Philly over to Camden. And they were like, whoa, why don't we have this in Philly? So we actually interviewed different community members. And they were interested. We surveyed folks. And folks were interested. So, you know, we went on a mission about four or three years ago. We started walking block by block, you know, writing down vacant parcels that we saw. You know, we followed the process that was laid out by the land bank on how to submit expression of interest, how mm-hmm. to access land. And, you know, we probably generated a list of 20 parcels in South Philly. And as we went through the process of, trying to find out who owns it and how much it costs, I mean, that was when you really saw the barriers to land access that many people are facing to start gardens. And also folks who have gardens are also facing in terms of their gardens being threatened. Fast forward to last year, we actually, because it was so hard to find a piece of land, we actually partnered with a high school, Furness High School, and we started a community school garden there. And actually last year, you know, right when we were about to break ground, we found that there was lead in the site. And, you know, that's
not surprising.
Not surprising.
In Philadelphia.
This was also the time that, you know, the lead investigation really broke out in Philly of what a huge issue asbestos and lead is in Philadelphia schools. And, you know, our students really rallied and really organized themselves and their parents and their community members to be like, you know, we wanted to build this garden and we still are. And we deserve a clean school. Mm-hmm. And so they actually testified and they actually won the money that was needed to clean that space.
That's a great story.
Yep. It is.
That's a great story.
Well, you know, I think that's an example of, you know, it's not just about food, as Ash was saying.
Mm-hmm.
We might start off as, you know, building a project to grow food, but it actually, you know, it actually is about what does it mean to bring a people together to self-govern, to decide what our community needs, and then, you know, connecting the garden to other issues that are happening in our community.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me go to you, Ebony. The word land bank was said, and this is a complicated story. There's been a lot of concerns and criticism that the land bank, which, you know, obviously is the kind of gateway to getting access to this land, has been slow to respond and to sort of sign off on some of these parcels. What is the status today?
Another loaded question. So
I guess you get the loaded
questions. Questions for Ebony.
That sounds great.
You're the lawyer here. So.
What is the status today? I will say that the land bank right now is in the process of going through the public commenting period and just redrafting its strategic plan and also its acquisition and disposition policies. There's been a lot of public concern about the lack of transparency mm-hmm. around the land bank in general and some of the policies that it has adopted in terms of its acquisition and disposition policies. We're hoping and by we, I mean, you know, myself over at the Public Interest Law Center and, you know, other advocates around the city, that the land bank is listening to the growers' concerns, specifically around a lot of the policies in the disposition policy that limit who can really access city-owned land.
And we should say the land bank is city-owned land, right?
The land bank is city-owned land. The land bank does have the capability to acquire privately owned tax delinquent land. We have used that process a few times when we have gardens who are on city-owned land, are on privately owned tax delinquent land, are afraid it's going to go to sheriff's sale. They get a sheriff's sale notice. And then generally, if you have the support of your council person, you can reach out and say, hey, can you put our parcel on this list, this magical, mysterious list? And the land bank goes to the sheriff's sale and actually acquires it. The problem then becomes getting it back in some instances, not in all instances. I've heard stories and I've had certain client situations where the land bank has acquired a parcel from sheriff's sale with the intention of putting it back into, you know, this person or this organization's generally person's ownership. But then the disposition policies as they're written currently are very limiting in that regard. So I don't want to get too technical, but there are a couple of different options for individual owners. And either you're going to get it as a side yard or a backyard type situation, which allows you to acquire it for nominal value. But a side yard and a backyard or a rear yard is a very specific definition. You know, you have to meet certain criteria.
You have to be a side yard or a backyard,
you have to be
right?
a side yard or a backyard, and you have to have lived there for a certain number of years. And I believe you have to, the neighborhood has to have a certain median household price. So there are a lot of different requirements there. And if you don't meet those criteria, it's very difficult to get the land back for nominal value. A lot of times you end up having to, in theory, pay fair market value. And there are a lot more options for nonprofit organizations, but, you know, there are a lot of organizations in the city that are doing great work that the city's not necessarily doing that aren't necessarily nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. They need to make a profit. And then there are also sort of equity issues around that as well, because everyone doesn't necessarily have the capability to become a nonprofit or a 501c3 because it's very expensive. So the land bank has tried to address that, and now they are allowing applications from unincorporated nonprofit organizations or unincorporated nonprofit entities. And that's a much simpler process in theory. But so what we do, or what I do, a lot of what I do is educating people around these options, but also shepherding people through the process. But I'm just one person, right?
Sure.
So, and there are a lot of gardens. So my main focus for the past year or so, in addition to representing, you know, my specific clients, has been trying to train other attorneys to do this work and also getting the word out to community members about what their rights are. So we have a pretty robust list right now of gardens in need of representation. And we've been, you know, doing this train the trainers, sort of thing, where we host CLEs or continuing legal education credits courses for attorneys in the city who are interested in representing a garden. So we held one in April. We're actually having one tomorrow. I generally host these in conjunction with the Law Center's legal director, Mimi McKenzie. There's one tomorrow at Deckard. So if you're an attorney interested in representing a community garden, please feel free to reach out to me at the Public Interest Law Center or go on, I believe it's on Deckard's website, and see if you can register for the CLE tomorrow.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Ebony Griffin, again, staff attorney at the Public Interest Law Center, she just said. And also with us, Ash Richards. She is, Philadelphia's first urban agriculture director, just on the job in the last month or so. And Lon Din, farm projects director at Viet Lead. And we are talking about farming in Philadelphia. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ash, what I hear is you're going to be very busy.
Yes. I'm
looking
very busy.
Looking into the future. I mean, yes. if things get Absolutely. Better with the land bank and there's more land available that people can use to develop for either farming or for their gardens, there's going to be a lot more activity. What is your vision? What do you, as you look into your crystal ball, what will Philly look like?
I have so many crystal balls. I mean, which one? I have to pick one.
So right.
I think that sort of, there certainly have been a lot of hurdles over the years. And I think that I sort of see the work that's being done to address those hurdles as a proactive thing. And I'm a collaborative person, personally. I think this takes collaboration. I think that working in silos is just really just digging the hole deeper. And I think that moving forward, my hope is that we corral not just the city agencies, but the gardeners and have them work together. That's the whole point. I think that a lot of folks have been asking and beating on the door and trying to get in to sort of say, you know, we're here. We want to be represented. And I think that a lot of city agencies want to do this work, but some of them don't know how. Mm-hmm. Some of them don't have the capacity to respond, or some of them don't have the will to sort of like stay on for such a complicated, convoluted process. It's not as easy as if you were, you know, a well-endowed developer to go out and buy land. You know, we're talking about folks. This conversation is also about racial and economic justice.
Absolutely,
right?
No question.
And so we're talking about folks who really have little to no resources. And for many people, this is not just a hobby. This is survival. And so I want to, with this plan, with my position, I want to be able to build those bridges and do the best that I can in doing that. And so I hope that my intention is to make sure that I move forward with grounds of integrity. And I want to foster sort of this, you know, and operate in an equitable way, a transparent way, in an inclusive way. But I just don't want to say that, because we're doing it. And so I think that we can show that we're doing it. And I hope that, you know, my colleagues to the right and left of me sort of keep us accountable. I mean, that's a part of this is a sure. conversation. And so I think we can do it. My hope is that the plan, the urban agriculture plan, and the other initiatives that we have going on for Farm Philly, for example, that we've been doing, you sort of brings people together in ways that we've never seen before.
Let me read an email from Jen. I help maintain Holman Field in Germantown, which has a community garden and park space. We were approached by Neighborhood Garden Trust to help preserve the field, and they pointed us to the Philadelphia Water Department, which is installing a stormwater containment system that will protect it from development for 50 years. Being involved with saving our green spaces in Philadelphia has been very encouraging. So obviously, this you're looking at me like, whoa.
That's great.
Yeah, okay.
That's awesome.
I mean, that good things are happening.
Yeah, and I was going to say, we also work really closely with Jenny Greenberg, who is executive director of Neighborhood Garden Trust. She's a great ally and has been able to unlock areas of the land bank that we haven't necessarily been able to all the time just because of, like I was saying before about the disposition policies, the land bank tends to prefer. And, you know, I get it. In some respects, they tend to prefer more stable, quote unquote, and organized nonprofit organizations, just because you don't want the land to, you know, go back to being blighted. And so we're thankful that NGT is in that space and able to provide that resource. It's not the only resource, though. And I think that that's what one of my goals has been in trying to engage the land bank and helping them to sort of understand the limitations there.
Well, London, I mean, gardening, farming, it's not easy. I mean, it is. There are certain joys associated with it, but this is work. This mm-hmm. is hard work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard work, and I want to uplift Soil Generation, mm-hmm. which is, and you know, Ebony and Ash are also a part of Soil Generation, along with many other farmers and gardeners in Philly. Soil Generation is a Black and Brown led coalition of farmers and gardeners in Philly, who really came together. In a time where gardens were really being threatened, and now, you know, really be on the same page about, you know, we're here, urban garden has a rich history in Philly, and we're here to stay. You know, definitely want to shout out the different gardens that aren't on here. Mill Creek, Urban Tree Connection, mm-hmm. Life Do Grow, Sankofa, Lighthouse, Norris Square, mm-hmm. Eastwick, Marco, Pentridge, Viola, North Philly Peace Park. I mean, the list goes on.
I was going to say, we're talking hundreds here, right?
We're talking hundreds. and you know, this past year, especially during city council elections, because city council has so much power over land, because of councilmanic prerogative, you know, that was put into place, written through the land bank policy, where council people have the last say in how land is used.
True.
You know, we really came together as a coalition to be like, this is what we need. This is what we need as growers, because growing is so hard. You know, when we grow, we're not thinking about just this year. We're thinking about 5 years ahead of us. We're building infrastructure. We're building, you know, tool sheds, things that need to be protected that we don't have just a 1 year lease. Thanks, Ash. more
Ashley
on that.
Is now directing the show. That is the break. That is the theme music. We'll pick up on what you were just saying there, Londin. Ebony Griffin and Ash Richards, we are talking about farming in Philadelphia. And again, yes, we are live taking calls. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about agriculture, gardening here in Philadelphia. There are close to 500 plots being tended by residents all over the city. But it turns out that about half of them, maybe even more, are on abandoned land or are on land owned by somebody else. And developers are looking to put up apartment buildings and office buildings. So there is some competition about how to preserve this farming community, our agriculture community that has deep roots here in the city of Philadelphia. Our guests are Londin, Farm Projects Director at Viet Lead, Ebony Griffin, a staff attorney at the Public Interest Law Center, and Ash Richards, Philadelphia's first urban agriculture director. And we got a couple of comments here. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Lon, you wanted to talk about something called Soil Generation.
Yes. So Soil Generation is a coalition of Black and Brown led farmers and growers in Philadelphia fighting for, you know, food justice, land justice in Philly. And connecting, you know, our right to land, to healing, to growing, and for community control. And so some of, you know, it's been a year-long process. We have monthly meetings. And as growers were coming together, we developed a list of demands that we really want to hold the city accountable to. And I want to take this opportunity to share that with folks. You know, the first one is ending the tax abatement. So, you know, we can't just talk about land access without connecting it, you know, intersecting it with how is gentrification even happening in Philly? How are property values increasing? How are developers being incentivized? And, you know, the 10-year tax abatement came around at a time during Philly's Great Recession. And around the 1997, you know, as a way to spur development in Philly in the time that Philly needed development. And what we see now is that, you know, we don't need the tax abatement anymore. And it's also unfairly developing certain areas of the city. And it is going towards developers more so than small homes and families. And
can you do just one more, only because we got a bunch of folks here and some other comments as well. Yes. I hate to do that to you, Lon.
Okay. And then so the second one is putting in a moratorium to the sheriff's sale of gardens who are being sent to sheriff's sale. And the last one that we talked about was transparency in the land bank process.
Let me go back to you, Ash, and you wanted to comment on the comment that we had about that, you know, this place in Germantown and the water department stepped in, and you wanted to speak to that.
Yeah, so absolutely. I think that one of my many hats is I actually used to work at Philadelphia Water Department, and that agency is also looking at gardens as a way to invest in green stormwater infrastructure, and that department is only going to do that on land that is that is going to be there for the next 50 years. And so what that comment sort of was getting at was an incredible workaround. Mm-hmm. So if there are agencies in the city that are willing and able to work with community gardens and farms in sort of this partnership way. And one more point about that is that in the Parks and Rec system, we also lease land out to gardens and farms, which is really important because the major benefit of having gardens and farm on parkland is that it's inherently preserved land. Right. And so that's something that our agency is wanting to explore. We want to see these activities happening on parkland. And so that's something that we want to grow into the future and build out some of the programming that we already have. Like, for example, we have a propagation program that at low cost people can propagate plants in the Horticultural Center in West Fairmount. And so there's different types of programs that we can sort of harness and grow. And so we just need, you know, those things need to be transparent to the greater community and not just sort of like, you know, piecemeal. You have one person here and one person there. We actually need to make a concerted effort to publicize these programs more deeply so that we're reaching more folks.
Ebony, you wanted to talk about, let's say someone then gets title to some land. They want to farm it. They want to grow things on it. Then what happens?
Then you have to keep it. So
you have to pay taxes.
To pay taxes generally. So if we're talking about an individual owner and we're talking about an individual owner getting title through adverse possession, you're probably going to get that with the real estate taxes on it, and you need to pay those or enter into some sort of arrangement with the city in order to prevent it from going to sheriff sale. If you're dealing with a nonprofit organization, generally speaking, if a nonprofit gets title from the city, the land should come free of tax debt. But we have had situations, we're actually in litigation right now with the city around a garden or an organization with a huge number of parcels that were transferred with the tax debt still on them, and then they were threatened with sheriff sale. And so we are working through the process, which is essentially to file a nunk-pro-tunk petition with the city.
What is that?
Nunk-pro-tunk is my favorite legal term. It basically means, hey, I'm sorry, can I, you know, file an exemption a little late and not pay these taxes.
I like your translation better than the Latin.
Yes. I would also like that as well.
So there are a lot of different, you know, methods that you can use, but it's really important to just make sure that you're proactive and that you're paying attention, looking at the fences around your property, making sure you don't see any sheriff sale postings, and also checking revenue's websites to see if there are any mysterious tax balances that are showing up. Or you can call us.
Okay, fair enough. Let me read. Brenda says, I'm a horticultural therapist in Philadelphia. A lot of people don't realize the value of horticulture therapy.
Yes,
after they're done, the kids I work with are so calm. They learn how to work within a team, which really, Lon, gets to a lot of what you're doing with students, right?
I think the healing piece of farming, growing, I think is critical. You know, as I was growing up and I saw my parents grow, and, you know, as we were resettling in Philly and how hard that was as folks displaced from their land and being, you know, resettled in a new place, and how actually recreating a sense of home is through a reconnection to the land, and how just touching soil and how tending plants has a way of, you know, slowing us down to heal ourselves, to reconnect us, you know, literally to our roots, and also to the life that is in the soil that we, you know, as city people, we don't necessarily touch soil and touch that whole nother life beyond us every day.
Well, and it gets to the point, there's so many immigrants, refugees. I mean, the city, absolutely. I'm looking at you, Ash. Yes, I mean, yeah, the city is such a diverse and we, rich place.
It is,
to
and
live.
We just kicked off Immigration Month yesterday, and Love Park and the mayor spoke about this. And I think that it's interesting because, you know, I'm sitting here in my capacity as the urban agriculture director, but I totally identify with what Juan is saying. You know, in my family, both of my parents mm-hmm. are immigrants as well, meaning that they came from somewhere else than the United States, and they came from Jamaica. And when they established themselves and they raised their family, we traveled all over the country. We traveled all over the world. I mean, and when we landed in, you know, the South Florida, we grew anything that we could possibly get our hands on that was from our cultural heritage. And so we grew ackee trees, you know, soursop, sweet sop, and sugar cane and avocado and different things like that. And that had a major impact on me as an individual and a part of addressing and assessing my culture. And clearly I'm still in it because this is just, it's informed my worldview tremendously, that part of that cultural heritage, that seed saving, passing down that ancestral practice to me mm-hmm. was so important that my parents did that and that my grandparents were also farmers as well. And so we come from a farming family, and that's not to be looked down upon or frowned on. It's to be celebrated. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's such one of the most richest things that you can give to your families and friends and your children.
Is handing down those
absolutely.
Kinds of traditions.
Absolutely.
We haven't talked about chickens. We haven't talked about bees. And we focus largely on things like seeds.
Yes.
But
yes.
We're talking chickens and bees.
And animals. It's happening in the city. This is not necessarily what we might address today, but it's happening. There are advocates out there who are starting to really increase their levels of advocating for animal keeping, including bees and chickens and goats and et cetera. And so if we can... On the city side, we need to address that in the ways of what's allowable. And if we allow it, what are the practices that make sure that the animals are taken care of and the humans are doing, you know, right by, you know, city standards,
sure.
for example, to make sure that we're doing this in a healthy way, because we certainly don't want to sort of we want to make sure we cross the I's and dot the I's and cross the T's when it comes to health, public health and animal keeping, et cetera. But I think that it's here and we will address it in the future.
I was reading a study from the Center for a Livable Future, and they were looking at things like urban mm-hmm. agriculture. And they, you know, they said, in many ways, it's a wonderful thing, but, you know, you can't feed a whole city by people having farms
sure.
and gardens.
Absolutely.
I think we can agree on that.
Yes, we can.
That it can, but doesn't always encourage healthier diets, but mm-hmm. that's one way to think about it. The social benefits that we were talking about, improving property values. I don't know. Is that is that something important? Increasing social bonds, even things like cooling down cities, dealing with things like air pollution. I mean, it seems like all of that is related. Lon, you want to weigh in on that?
I mean, I think, as Ash said, when we look at farming and gardening, we have to see how it's intersectional. Mm-hmm. You know, how land justice is economic justice. Because how land and property taxes are interconnected, it's also connected to education justice.
Right.
You know, going back to tax abatement, because how it has spurred development and how that has increased, you know, gardens being threatened, that the property taxes that developers are not paying because of the 10-year abatement is not going to schools. And so when we see schools, you know, getting found with lead and asbestos, we can't see these as inseparable. When we see affordable housing being bulldozed down, we can't see these things as inseparable. We got to see things at the root, and we got to see how, you know, how we treat the land is how we treat the people. And so how do we shift then for our purpose of land ownership, right, in Philly, about profit? How do we shift that to be about land stewardship for people and for community? Because it is... that will be the foundational of how our community and our city will flourish.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Ebony, do we know how many vacant properties there are in Philly? I know some people keep track of this stuff, but do we even know?
Not really. The number sort of
fluctuates.
It fluctuates. I believe there are around, I want to say 1,000. Well, no. So It depends on the type of vacant land that you're talking about. So if you're just talking about vacant land in general, the number is hugely high. If you're talking about vacant privately owned land, it's really hard to say. And again, it's the number fluctuates because, you know, it changes every year. Last I checked,
I think there
were 40,000 parcels.
40,000.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary.
Just in general.
In general, just to sort of put all our conversation in context. Let me read an email from Monica. She says, in West Philadelphia, new pending apartment buildings plans are in the works along places that used to be community gardens. Are there ways to limit overdevelopment on unstable ground that neighborhoods would have preferred to keep as gardens? Ash, I'm back to you.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I think that this question is critical because it's not that I think we have to look at what's not there. So, for example, are there policies to keep people in their homes? Because there's policies to develop the city, right? And so we have to kind of look at what's not there. And I think it's just really important to say that there is not right now no way, and Ebony, jump in if you will, but there's no way to sort of stop that. If the developer, which sometimes they might come from out of the state, comes in and swoops in and buys this land, and it's fair based off of our policies, it's a fair purchase, that land is now technically their land.
Right.
And so that's why the advocacy is really important, because there's ways that you could sort of address those issues through the advocates and through community organizing. And potentially you could get, you know, politicians involved, et cetera. But as far as policy goes, I think that maybe this is going to got us to push us in the right direction to start thinking about what policies are missing so that we can have conversations. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's a zoning issue, there's a process for that. The registered community organizations get to go through the Zoning Board of Adjustment. But if it's a by right development, it's by right. That's the policy.
Yeah, if you need a variance. So if the developer comes in, owns the land, and doesn't need any sort of variance in terms of the zoning, then you're basically, you know, out of luck. We have had success in sort of coming in and helping the communities organize around maybe a community benefits agreement with the developer. Right. Mm-hmm. That will essentially, one of my goals in my practice is to make sure that community long-term residents have a voice in things in their neighborhood and, you know, what's going on. And so we've been successful in engaging those conversations with developers, figuring out what the community actually wants and seeing if there's some way to sort of incorporate that into the development, or, you know, even like a side development, or, you know, a monetary donation or gift to the residents or the RCO. So there are things that you can do, but Ash is absolutely correct. You know, if it's a by right development and the developer doesn't care, you're kind of, you know, out of luck.
Almost out of time here. Ash, I'm going to give you the last word, but I guess the goal is to find some kind of coexistence. I mean, you know, you want development, you want people moving to the city, you want a vibrant culture, and you want to have gardens.
Yeah, and we want people to stay. I mean, this movement, garden movement is not just, it's the gardeners are working with people. These are folks who want to stay.
Right.
And so when you use that as a way to frame the conversation, who wants to stay? We're talking about folks who are being priced out with affordable housing community. We're talking about, you know, LGBTQ community that don't have housing. We're talking about homelessness. We're talking about so many different genres of people. So that's what's bringing people together. Who wants to say? And we are committed to a better process. And I think that's really important to say that today. And I thank you all for being here and showing up.
Well, I thank you for showing up as well. Mm-hmm. Ash Richards, Philadelphia's first urban agriculture director. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times. Ebony Griffin, staff attorney at the Public Interest Law Center. Ebony, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Lon Din is farm projects director at Viet Lead. And Lon, thanks for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.